You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, as a makeshift tribute to those killed in the Belgian terror attacks begins to fade, we'll discuss whether there should be a permanent memorial for those who lost their lives there. And
the East German government often distorted the street plans of maps of East Berlin, so that if people were trying to escape across the wall, they'd get hopelessly confused.
What do maps reveal about the history and politics of our greatest cities? And not long to go now before... Yes, love it or loathe it, Eurovision's grand finale is the only thing you'll be watching tomorrow night, I promise. And if it wasn't heated enough, Ukraine and Russia look set to battle it out to be crowned this year's champions. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guest today are Monocle's executive editor, Steve Bloomfield, and our business editor, Matt Allagaier. Thank you both for joining us on the show. The end of I don't know why it's been a big week, but I know you've been crunching numbers this week, Steve.
I have been crunching numbers. We've been working out our top 25 for the Quality of Life survey, which will be coming out in our July-August issue. And I think we've worked out who the winner is. Not that we can obviously say that for quite some time now. But yes, it's one of the big things we do every year, and a thing that's watched with interest in city halls across the world.
It's the kind of our equivalent of Eurovision, actually, which we're going to be coming to later. I think that the tussling, the intrigue, battles.
There's been less singing so far, but there's been some wailing.
But there have been some good costumes I've seen while the numbers have been counted. Matt, you disappeared for one day this week. I think you headed back to your old hood. You were doing a bit of reporting.
That's right, yeah. I was doing a report up in Walthamstow in North London. And I was
visiting. You get all the glamorous gigs.
I know. It's either there or Dresden for me. So I was there visiting a factory. It's the first or the only company making jeans in London at the moment, which is, very interesting. And that'll be in the July-August issue.
We look forward to seeing your denimed legs over the coming weeks. We'll see what happens there. But today we're going to start with a sadder, more thoughtful moment, which is this. In an hour from now, the last post will be played, as it is every night at the Menin Gate in the Belgian town of Ypres. It's a moving tribute to those who gave their lives for the defence of Belgium in the Great War. The recent terror attacks in Brussels have once again put the country and commemoration in the spotlight. A makeshift memorial was erected in the city in the wake of the terror there, but the laid flowers have since wilted and the area is now strewn with rubbish. So should Belgium now create a lasting memorial to those killed in the March attacks? And if so, what's the best way to do this? Steve, I'll begin with you. It's an intriguing thing. You know, I guess there's a desire on some people to rush to memorialise these things, you know, to have, even this is only a few weeks after the attacks, to make some kind of statement. Do you think it is the right time to be considering what that is, or should there be a longer period of gestation while you contemplate the attacks?
I think they should be thinking about it right now, but the decision on what the memorial should be isn't something that should be rushed. It's something that needs to be fought over, argued over by residents of the city, by the families of the victims, by everyone who has a stake in making Brussels the city that it is. And, you know, Brussels is a democracy, and it's a democracy at the heart of Europe, and there needs to be a proper argument about what happens to memorialise what happened at the airport and the subway station. And you only have to look at the battles that have taken place in New York over Ground Zero, where you had Daniel Libeskind's incredible master plan, which ended up being torn this way and that way by various people who had a say. But there was a democratic process. Everyone was involved in New York. Everyone was able to have their voice heard. And yes, it's taken a long time. It took more than a decade before anything was really, truly there. But that process was as important, actually, as the memorial that stands there at the end.
Matt, it's interesting. I was looking back at what happened in London after the attacks here that we had. And even to this day, many years later from those bomb attacks, the bomb attack that was in a bus in Tavistock Square, they had put up a memorial in Hyde Park to all the people who lost their lives that day. But actually in Tavistock Square, they're still contemplating what they will do. And again, I wonder, you know, for you, do you think those memorials are there for the city, for ordinary residents? Should we be reminded of these things every day? Or are they meant to be kind of smaller and more modest? Are they moments of contemplation for just the families?
Well, I think they should be a bit of both. I mean, I think it's right that people who live in London should walk past a plaque on the floor or on the wall and have that moment of reflection that we've just mentioned. I think that that is very important. I think it's worth bearing in mind that we are one community in the city, and it's good that we can all share that, I think. But of course, it's somewhere where the families and the friends of those who lost their lives can also reflect on that, and it becomes a kind of a nucleus for that, I guess.
Steve?
I walk past a memorial every day on my way into work at King's Cross Station. There was a fire there in the 1980s, 31 people were killed, and there's a bronze plaque on the wall in King's Cross Station, memorialising those who died, with next to it a clock. And every now and then, it catches your eye. And okay, the tube has changed dramatically since then. There are no wooden escalators, you can't smoke. And yet every now and then, it just catches your eye and you think, is this, and it just reminds you that this thing happened right where you are. So there is always this sort of slight danger of memorials, that they can catch you unawares and remind you of something when you don't really want to remember it.
But I think in a way that is probably the good thing. There is a kind of like the trigger that suddenly pulls you back. I'm always nervous of these memorials which kind of demand your attention in a way. So I think Ground Zero, I've been to see it, and I find it slightly... It is a haunting, it's quite an amazing thing, that water rushing down through a hole, disappearing. It feels a little bit hellish, there's something about it as well, which is probably fit. But on the whole, I think that memorials are best when you almost have to kind of seek them out a little bit, when they're a bit lower key, or that you do just catch them out the corner of your eye and something trips you up. Do you think, you know, I was just bringing back to London, I wonder whether you think, you know, there are so many attacks, unfortunately, these days, and so many things go wrong. Does the cityscape get too crowded? Is it competitive almost in the way that we will have to memorialise these things if we're kind of living through a new age of terror?
No, I don't think so. I think actually London's memorials are... As you say, they're ones that you don't necessarily... You have to sort of seek them out. And whether that is the one for the 7/7 bombings in London, which actually most people, if they... I think I imagine a lot of people have seen that in London and not been sure what it is, the thing Hyde Park with the 52 columns, because it's slightly out of the way. There's not anything really nearby which says what it is. I think memorials are a good thing, and they, you know, we're a big city. There's unfortunately more than enough space for as many memorials as we may need.
Matt, what do you think the memorial should do? Because I don't know if you've been to see the Holocaust memorial in Berlin, which is an extraordinary thing, and a bit like what Steve's talking about here in Hyde Park. It's almost like contemporary art. It's a beautiful thing. But the strange thing is, it's so beautiful that in the summer you go there and there are people sitting on top of the plinth, sunbathing, hanging out, having their packed lunches. And I'm not sure whether a memorial should scare us a little bit, should, you know, make us, you know, feel solemn, or should it be something, is a space that you just go to hang out and you're reminded subliminally almost of what it means?
I think I was going to bring up that memorial. It is amazing. I think it does a bit of both, because it's obviously, for people who don't know, it's a series of columns quite tightly placed together, and you can walk in between them, and when you walk below, the ground actually sort of disappears, and you end up going quite deep. And it becomes very dark very quickly. And I think that's something that's quite amazing. People do stand on top of them, sit on top of them in the sun. But you can then go down below and actually you're sort of surrounded by these very intimidating concrete blocks. And it's dark down there. And I think it does a bit of both. It is part of the city and people use it. And hopefully they have a moment's reflection while they're there. But equally, you can walk through it and have quite a poignant experience, I would say.
Steve?
I think more thought is being given to the way memorials are built now. If you compare the memorials now to those after, say, the Second World War, and many of those were traditional, you know, here lies so-and-so, this memorializes the people that died. They had a very sort of traditional sort of feel to them. But there is, of course, a danger that you go a bit too far the other way, and they are supposed to, you know, to make us think about people who've died in horrific circumstances. And sometimes they can feel like they tip over into contemporary art a bit more than is perhaps necessary.
I think what's the other interesting thing is it depends when these things happen how you remember them, because when you think about the Second World War, you know, the number of people who were killed, the bombs, etc., in a way there was too much to remember. You know, a city can't take on that huge amount of memory in one go. So in a way, it kind of dumps the information. You know, you walk down a street now where people were killed, where bombs went off, where buildings disappeared, and there's no marker of it at all. It's kind of, maybe you'll see a kind of a scuff on a bit of stonework where something flew through the air. But oddly, these more singular moments of terror, they become much more, I don't want to use the word in the wrong way, but almost fetishized in a way I'm a little bit cautious whether it's almost like the bad luck of the or the good luck of the time, that how you get remembered.
Well, you can't remember everything, and you know it's interesting to look at London, for example. There's a website called Bombsight, and site is spelled SIGHT, which is essentially a map which it marks every single bomb that went off in London during the Second World War. And it is astonishing. And you look at your own neighbourhood and go, oh, okay, yeah, that's why that house looks slightly different from the other one, because that's where a bomb went off. And so if you want to know this information, you can. But I think I'm glad that there isn't a mark on every house, on every street, which says where something happened.
No, but when you come back to Berlin, again, I think I do find the Holocaust Memorial, you know, impressive in some way. But what I find even more kind of haunting is when you go to Mitte and you're just walking along the cobbled streets, and outside every house where Jewish people were taken away, taken to concentration camps, they've attempted to put these little brass plaques that, you know, are so modest. You're just walking back and forth across them all day without seeing them. But on there, they mark the names, you know, in just a simple list. And I think what that does better than that big memorial is that you stop in front of a building that may have stood there since that time, and you can't help but look up at the windows and think, oh my God, this is where people came from, and this is how a city remembers. I think, anyway, it's a fascinating topic, how memory sits within cities, how memory sits within, you know, a collective consciousness, how memory sits within buildings. But for the people of Brussels, Steve, in the end, you think a moment of pause before we go any further?
I think they should start talking about it now, and I think the flowers should be picked up that are there now, and the air should be cleaned. But then there needs to be a discussion which begins right now about what comes next. There is no rush in terms of, you know, designing something, working out where it's going to go, what it's going to be. And they should, you know, embrace the fact that this will take a long time, and everyone should be involved. This is, you know, Brussels is going through, you know, has a real issue at the moment of how it comes together as a city. This memorial, the decision over the memorial, has to be part of that process.
Well, we're actually going to stay within the city boundaries, because yesterday on The Urbanist here on Monocle 24, we were discussing what maps do for our towns and cities and what they reveal also about our pasts.
In terms of distortions on the map, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the idea that many map makers now introduce cul-de-sacs, or in some cases even small villages, depending on the scale of the map, which don't actually exist, so they can tell if somebody else is infringing their copyright. But there are other, a lot more sinister reasons for distorting a town plan. For example, the East German government often distorted the street plans of maps of East Berlin, so that if people were trying to escape across the wall, they'd get hopelessly confused.
Matt, it's interesting. I don't think we've ever had more maps in our lives via our phones, via technology. It is always easy to know, it seems, exactly where you are. But oddly, I sometimes feel I know less about where I am because of that quantity of maps and because of their efficiency. So, for example, when you're looking at a map of a neighbourhood and you're trying to find how to, you know, turn right, turn left, get to the pub or to the restaurant you're going to, you never see a city in its entirety, in its scale anymore. So often when I'm, you know, go to a city that I don't know at all, I'm amazingly good at getting from A to B and using the transport and knowing how many minutes it's going to take me to walk. But I have very little conception anymore of what that city looks like. Are you a person who is actually better than me at kind of understanding how the city fits together digitally? Or are you somebody who would still like to unfold a nice piece of flapping paper in the wind?
I think I'm probably more like you, to be honest. I'm exactly the same. When you get the tube in London, for instance, you pop up over ground. And because the maps are so readily available, as you say, on your phone, you never really think about how things actually link up to each other. So you come above ground and you suddenly just take up your phone and you know that it's a 2-minute walk to the next place. But I always find cyclists in cities really know their way around and they know how things link up and they know how big the city is because they have to cover it over the roads, obviously. So I've always felt that I'm slightly bad at that. I can't quite understand how things link up.
Just bringing back this, Steve, this notion of memory, the other funny thing about, you know, because these maps are updated every like few minutes and they get pushed to your phone, whatever, you're never looking at an old map in a way. So it's strange when you used to get the A to Z, it used to be infuriating because, you know, another road had been built or it's so small it fell apart in your hands, whatever. But in a way, you could go back and pick up, you know, an A to Z from 2 or 3 years ago to remind yourself of what a neighbourhood was like. And I know there are many people who seek out, you know, for example, you know, an A to Z from the 50s or from pre-war because they want to know what the city looked like. Again, digitally, it's not a kind of format for remembering very well again.
It's not, but what's interesting is that, yes, we're living in a time where we use digital maps now on our phone, and yet antique maps, the business for antique maps is booming. You know, you go to a map fair or you go to any number of the map shops that you'll find in most major Western cities, and they're doing huge business these days because people like them as works of art as well. And a sort of, there's a nostalgia to it. If, you know, if you're moving into a new neighbourhood, oh, well, let's get a map of what this used to look like 100 years ago. There's something evocative about looking at an old map and seeing that the street you're on still used to exist 100 years ago, or actually it didn't at all. And where you live now is, you know, it was all fields around here 100 years ago, Andrew, all fields.
But what's also fascinating for you, you're a foreign editor, your stories are coming out of that world. 50-60% of all the stories you do are about where a cartographer drew a line on a map, or somebody wanting to move that line, or an interpretation of a map. You know, and all the organisations are wrapped around just arguing over where that damn line goes.
Absolutely. The number of countries I've been to where there is a straight line denoting where one country ends and another begins is astonishing. And it's, you know, these countries have been cut up without any thought as to where the people that live in them would like to be. And we're seeing now, obviously, in many parts of the world, but particularly in the Middle East, that those straight lines have become, and this is perhaps something of an understatement, a slight problem.
Well, we're going to stick with borders, nationalities, the odd tussle, maybe the odd punch here and there too, because up next, this year's Eurovision, it could be between Ukraine and Russia. And to make matters worse, the Ukrainian entry is all about Stalin. Well, get the popcorn out and have your country flag at the ready when we return after this.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Okay, it's not long to wait now.
Yeah!
hope you're still feeling well after all that. Now, tomorrow night we're going to be glued to our TV screens as the very best and the very worst of European pop troupes battle it out in Stockholm with the hope of being crowned the winners of Eurovision 2016. It's all going to be pom-poms and glitter balls, I promise. Well, still with me are Steve Bloomfield and Matt Allagaya, and also now our culture editor, Robert Bound, has joined us too. Rob, culture, Eurovision, can
the two go? Are not mutually exclusive, Andrew.
Do you like a bit of Eurovision?
I love a bit of Eurovision. Always loved it. It was always a kind of family favourite, and then it becomes sort of an ironic favourite, and a kind of like you'd have a lot of drinking games on sort of, you know, how many skirts were perhaps ripped off, Bucks Fizz style, and you know, and then of course you've got the dodgy voting drinking game as well. You know, you've got your Greeces and your Cypresses, and you've got you have a geographical interest. It's interesting. I think as you said, you teed this conversation up talking about borders and bringing in Stephen, and I think that probably he's the only man really with the credentials to sort out the amazing geopolitics at the heart of Eurovision. But I think it'll be a classy night because it's in Stockholm. But yeah, it's an interesting the odds are interesting, as you say. Ukraine and Russia look to be right at the top. If you're UK 25th out of 26
if you're having a wager, any tunes you've heard that you think
I always like, the Dutch always seem to be pretty good. I always think the Belgians actually always seem to be kind of rather good. And the Scandies and the Nords are pretty decent. I mean, you know,
because the Swedes take it super serious. I think it takes up the whole year, the preparations for kind of choosing their band.
We were just editing the Monocle Minute for tomorrow morning, and there's this stat in there which I didn't believe, which is that 85% of people watching TV in Sweden when Eurovision will be watching that.
Does that say a bit about what the rest of Swedish TV is? Yeah.
It might do.
And Steve, we were concerned that, you know, this was a very political song coming out of Ukraine, but you pointed out there's actually been a song about kind of the European Union before.
Oh, yeah. Look, so if you go back to 1990, Italy won with a song that celebrated the upcoming signing of the Maastricht Treaty. So, yeah.
that was a cover version of an old Grateful Dead song.
Tutto Cotugno.
Yeah.
So, no, politics has always been at the heart of it, not just in the voting, as Rob was saying, you know, Greece will give 12 points to Cyprus and vice versa, but also, you know, in terms of the messages that people want to put out. So, you know, a lot of the Baltic nations in the early 2000s, a lot of their songs were about freedom and independence and, you know, explain that look at who we are right now. And even, you know, you look at Israel and who they've had in the past 20 years. They had Dana International in 1998, the first transgender winner of Eurovision. And then also our friend Mira Awad in 2009, a Palestinian Israeli singing with a Jewish Israeli. It was an attempt by Israel in both those cases to try and portray their country in a different light.
Now, we should point out that Fernando is there. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our kind of steely-eyed reporter, has
I hope it's warm enough for shorts in Stockholm.
I think they're going to think he's an entrant, aren't they? Who knew that Brazil was suddenly in the Eurovision?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
If he had a choice between being Brazilian president or Brazil's first Eurovision entrant, I think he'd definitely go for the latter.
Absolutely.
And now, just tell me, when you watch it, Steve, can you unpick the politics from it, or do you actually enjoy it? Do you watch it as a kind of a political watcher?
do I watch it for the politics?
Well, I wondered where you got your ideas from.
Image of the Bloomfield parlour there, written by Andrew Tuck.
Well, I mean, it looks like entertainment, but I'm sure there's something political in it.
No, but it's interesting, for Austria, you know, again, yep. it showed a different, you know, a different light on the nation with Conchita Wurst. You know, here we have a country that's being, you know, at the moment kind of given a tough time for leaping to the right, for seeming to be insensitive. And that was that kind of changed the country's image in a really interesting way.
It really did. And then, you know, also to revert back to the UK, you know, in 2003 was the first time the UK got nul point. And possibly that had something to do with the fact that the artists were a group called Gemini, spelt with a J, and that they didn't sing in tune. And about a month later, the lead singer of Gemini was back working in a clothes shop in Liverpool. However, it probably also had a little bit to do with the fact that 2 months earlier, the Iraq war had started and no one in Europe wanted to give Britain any points.
Matt, Joe and Jake, that's the UK entrant. Do you know them?
I don't, not personally, or musically. Unfortunately.
Come on. You don't know Joe or Jake.
I'm intrigued. That's our entrant. I don't know who Joe and Jake are.
They've been.
It's not Joe Gwynn, is it?
They've been. Yeah, if he's taken 2 weeks off work, did you not notice? See you on stage.
Do you know who Joe and Jake are, Rob?
Yeah, they are. I think their talent show. They're sort of two
I thought you were
going to
say talentless.
They are talent show. Okay. They are the embodiment of it. I think they met on a talent show. They've been bigged up by Robbie Williams. So I think that they're quite likable, and I think the UK song has a sort of message of unity in it, which people might want to read something into. Poor old Ireland, the most successful country in the history of the Eurovision Song Contest, aren't even in it. Nicky Byrne from the Westlife, messed up big time, and it looked like no one in Ireland picked up their telephone or texted and voted. So,
do you think Ireland didn't realise that it was on last night, the semi-finals?
Yeah, probably.
It's possible.
Maybe.
They've got some suspiciously Anglophile names, these people. So Hungary, Freddie.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. So Jamie Lee from Germany, classic. I did like it in its sort of in its the heyday of singing in your own language, to be in the 80s. It was the Brits and sometimes the Dutch or the Swedes, or people who had very good English, or, you know, who write in English. Wrote songs in English. Now they all are in English, and it'd be interesting, or most of them are in English. Most people don't use their native language.
Out of the 42 entries, only 3 didn't have any English in it.
Right, yeah, see, it's interesting. And
even the French have a bit of English in it.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they don't like that.
Quel patron.
Zut alors.
Zut alors.
Oh, it's one so thing, amazing working on an international station.
One thing I would say before we finish, actually, is...
There's no need to finish. This is like a good hour to go, yeah.
Is this the half hour or the hour? How long is this? I mean,
and what do you think about Australia being in it?
Well, I think Australia being in it is a mark of the international reach of this competition. I think originally they liked it because it was kind of an ironic kind of festival thing that people would have parties for and embraced it. And now this year it is for the first time being broadcast in the United States on the Logo channel, which was originally an LGBT channel. So it's got a certain amount of kind of, it knows how to twirl and shimmy.
And on Australia as well, more viewing figure stats, 5.7 million people watched in Australia last time, which is about 1 in 4 Australians, which is
really?
Pretty impressive. Yeah, I know. It's
again,
quite something,
again,
isn't
with
it?
The Swedish model, Matt Alagaya is thinking, what's that tell you about the rest of Australian television?
I couldn't possibly comment.
We have a minute now for what we like to call house news. I'm going to give the first bit. The Urbanist
Live... roll call.
You better have something. The Urbanist Live event is going to be taking place here on June the 2nd. Go online at monocle.com, buy your ticket. It's going to be... We're going to be serving a nice glass of wine. We're going to have a conversation about, in the wake of the London mayoral election, about the future of the city. And it's going to be exciting and fun. Come. Steve, what have you got lined up?
House news.
Yes, house news.
I'm moving to a new house.
No. What about
Really? Yeah. But anyway.
What about the series?
Okay, I have got something to say, which is... I have got something to say.
What?
If you're in Geneva next week and you're a Monocle subscriber, then you should come along to the How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide book launch, which is in Geneva on Tuesday evening.
That's very correct, Steve. Well done. There is a series here, and I'm skimming across. The Globe is here all week. Here about it's all about on sea issue. Megan Gibson on naval warfare. Rob Bound on cruise ship entertainers. there you see the
warning,
reflection man.
Contains congas.
Alagai, you've got like 10 seconds. Anything you're doing next week?
Well, I'll be doing that. I'll be talking about the Boats and Coast Survey that's in the June issue and on our on-sea issue. So I'll be talking about that on the Globe list.
And hosing down the bins.
And hosing down the bins.
And also filing your copy, yeah?
Yeah, all of
and
that.
Not to be confused with the Boasting and Coats Survey, which we thought you were editing.
That's coming out in the autumn, yeah.
Well, I think you'll be relieved to know, but I'm afraid that is all there is for today. The show was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and also by Maria Grinina and our studio manager, Chris Chauvers. More music next, then at 1900 hours, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. And we'll have more on the day's main news stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori Haas will be back at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 hours London time. I'm Andrew Tuck. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great weekend and goodbye.